We're going to start today with a conversation with Naveen Shetty, CEO of Blueprint Registry. Naveen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, folks, I recently did Naveen's entrepreneur journey story and learned how he navigated his way, and I thought there were some very unique insights that I wanted to expose you all to. So maybe you have already read his entrepreneur journey stories, maybe you haven't. And in any case, I think this conversation will be enlightening for many of you to learn how he has done his early part of the entrepreneurial journey. There's a lot of entrepreneurial journey ahead of Naveen. So tell us about your business at Blueprint Registry. What do you do? How do you do what you do?
Yeah, again, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here. So Blueprint Registry is a wedding registry platform that's based on the visual layout of a home. So users come in and shop using top-down layouts of a room, and we aggregate gifts from multiple different retailers into one location to create a convenient experience. And ultimately, that's what we do. We connect newly engaged couples with a shopping platform to then share with their friends and family to buy gifts. And ultimately, that's the core focus, but it's been a long journey to get here, and it's a longer journey, as you mentioned, going forward.
So talk a little bit about the, especially the pivot in your journey. Talk about where you started and how and why you evolved to the current model.
Yeah, so I think the pivot comes in with a little bit of a backstory. So, you know, I was in New York for about 10 years working as an accountant in finance at a couple of different investment funds, and that was my life. And I really enjoyed it. I loved the markets. But I was moving apartments in New York, and I was trying to outfit my new apartment with furniture. And buying furniture online was a terrible process. And so in January of 2013, I had the idea, can you make the e-commerce experience more visual, more intuitive by shopping based on the layout of your home? And so that was the conception of the idea in January of 2013. Let's build an e-commerce experience that's based on the blueprint or layout of a home. It was a massive idea. I didn't know where to start. Found through friends of friends, found an unbelievable co-founder and designer. Her name is Lizzie. And, you know, I told her the idea, and she's like, Naveen, I think this is awesome. I'm moving from New York back to Seattle. I don't know where all my furniture is going. I just got married. I got all this stuff. I think this would be an awesome idea. And after thinking about that idea, then we came with how do we actually apply this? Like, what's the execution to get to the end result? And so we actually started in weddings to prove the concept of do people want to shop on the layout of a home? And so weddings is a one-time life event related to the home, and that's why we chose this. The pivot really became in the idea almost from the outset. So it was let's build e-commerce based on blueprints of homes. Wait, that's way too big of an idea. Let's narrow it to prove the concept and then scale from there.
Yeah. So it was more almost segmentation as opposed to pure pivot, I would say, isn't it?
Correct. So, yes, it is a bit of segmentation, I would say, just to prove the concept. But I think, you know, we haven't had a technical pivot, so to speak, but I think, you know, as most entrepreneurs know, every single major decision point is a small pivot, which adds up to, you know, a cumulative effect.
Right, and I think from a pure e-commerce site standpoint, the workflow of this business would be somewhat different than what it is for you, because there's that wedding registry component and so forth. So, yeah, there is a pivot in there, but it is more an evolution as opposed to a complete, like, switch.
Yeah, and so, I think
go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was just going to say, I think the important thing is to note we were open to the idea to do something different.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we had this great idea. It was really cool. But how do we get there? Okay, let's narrow this down and make it something that we can actually handle on our own. Because we bootstrapped, and we'll obviously talk about this, but it was a long bootstrap process, and I think it was the right way to go for us.
So you just mentioned that you were an accountant, and your co-founder is a designer, and you decided to outsource your software development. What have you learned in managing that process, and what did you do wrong? What did you do right? What, in hindsight, of course, you know, we have a lot of entrepreneurs who are non-technical co-founders. You know, there's a ton of entrepreneurs out there who are trying to do startups by doing the process that you have done successfully in your case, but a lot of entrepreneurs fail in managing an outsourced development process. So what can we learn from you on that score?
Yeah, and so I want to talk a little bit about this because I do think it's important. It's our biggest learning lesson so far. So, you know, I'm an accountant business guy. Lizzie's a designer. So from the outset, we had a very strong business plan. We had a very strong design and wireframe for the idea of what we wanted to do. Now it comes, okay, how do we actually build this? So we actually spent time meeting five development firms, getting proposals from five development firms before choosing one. We had a mix of both outsourced developers offshore and in the U.S. And I think what we came down to, you know, after talking, we did a lot of due diligence with these firms in terms of what their process was, how they build things, and there were kind of two components, right? Build this fast and cheap, and then you're going to have to rebuild it in a year, or build this with quality and incrementally over time. We didn't know the right direction. Neither Lizzie or I have any technical background. And, you know, we actually had to rely on these, you know, project managers or the people pitching us from these firms tell us. And that's a huge detriment to the business looking back on it now because, right, a core function of our business is development because we're a software company. We're an e-commerce company. That might differ for other people. But, you know, we thought we did a really good job with due diligence, got proposals, ended up choosing one in New York because we felt like we needed someone that we could talk with and communicate with clearly. So we decided not to do a firm in India, even though they were 50% cheaper, just because we didn't have the good communication there. And so we ended up choosing this firm in New York. And, you know, ultimately they built what they told us they would build, but it wasn't what we thought they would build because there was some translation issues in terms of the build. And I think going back, something I would recommend to everyone is, one is try to find a technical founder or someone technical on your team who can help vet development firms. I think that's incredibly important. And two is, you know, really manage what the scope of the project is. I mean, every development firm will tell you scope creep is an issue, but I think it's more about developing internally what the scope is. Like, what's the end result you want the site to be working and working for how long and how many people should it handle? Because otherwise, there's a lot of miscommunication because there's so many things happening at once. You know, development is just a small part of it, but it ends up being a bigger issue down the road.
And do you have any insight on the firm that you chose to go with in New York? What was the basis in which you chose those sites? Besides offshore versus onshore, you had some options in New York as well. Why did you choose the one you chose, and what was that decision, the correct decision or not the correct decision, and would another firm have been better? What did you learn in that process?
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. So we got five proposals, and those proposals ranged from 50K to 350K. So, I mean, a huge spread for the same business plan, same wireframes. And we ended up choosing this New York firm. They were in the middle of the range, coincidentally, but really they just had the best project management. They were really able to sell us on, hey, listen, you know, we can be technically your internal CTO. We'll help you build all this. And they honestly just sold us on their process. In hindsight, was that the best thing? I don't know. You know, we had two other firms that were very close. They had a different model. So another had a model where they would build the site very quickly and it's meant to break in a year and then we'd have to rebuild then. It's really hard to say. I think.
How long did it take you to get the MVP out?
Yeah, so we started building the MVP, I would say, in September of 2013. We launched in February 2014, so about maybe six months to get the MVP out.
Not bad.
Yeah.
Look, talk to us about your friends and family financing round. You did raise some money up front. How much did you raise?
Yep.
What did you do right in that round? What did you do wrong? And what, you know, what was the outcome?
Yeah, so we launched the website in 2014. So we bootstrapped for almost a year and a half. And then we raised our friends and family round. And when we went and raised our friends and family, we raised around $700,000, which sounds like a lot, but we raised that over almost a year period of time because it was a convertible note, it was open. And in hindsight, that was probably a mistake. But, you know, you kind of take what you can when you can. So an issue we had was we get a $100,000 check and then we wouldn't know when the next money would come in. And so maybe 2 months later we get $50,000, 2 months later we get another $150,000. So it's very hard to allocate capital appropriately and efficiently when you don't know how much capital you're going to have to begin with. And so in hindsight, we would have made it a much more concerted effort to do it in a 3-month sprint, raise all the money at once, and then deploy it in once, because that would have been probably much more efficient versus raising it over almost a year period of time.
So you bootstrapped with a paycheck for a year, right, before you raised the friends and family money?
Correct. So, you know, still, Lizzie and I still kept our day jobs. We did this on nights and weekends. And then, you know, almost 2 years later from the inception of the idea, then we did leave our firms to do this full time.
So it sounds like the friends and family round was while you still kept your jobs and you raised money, but you still held on to your jobs.
Correct. Yeah. So that's what we did. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, right, people say they invest in people, but really it's people plus idea. And so we had a really interesting idea. It was captivating from a numbers perspective, captivating from a business perspective, but also, like, you know, Lizzie and I had started businesses in our respective industries, and we were a really great team together. I mean, you know, I'm a male business guy. She's a female designer. We have a really interesting take on this business and a take on running a business. And so, you know, we were able to, luckily enough, to convince enough people to invest early on.
So split this 2-year bootstrapping with a paycheck period for me. And what did you accomplish in the 1 year leading up to that friends and family financing round in terms of you launched the MVP in about 6 months? How much did you do in terms of getting, you know, customers, like, you know, engaged couples and start transacting on your site? Were you able to get to that by the time you got to the friends and family round?
Yeah, definitely. So in terms of timeline, right, so, you know, conception of the idea was January 2013. We started building the MVP of September 2013. We launched the product February of 2014 and then kind of raised our first capital at the end of 2014. So in that time period when we launched in 2014, we had, you know, 80 people use the website, generated a couple $100,000 in sales, and that was the validation, right? This could work. The feedback was great from users. And really the way we got users was through word of mouth. I mean, Lizzie and I knew a lot of the people using the website. You know, we were in our late 20s, and so many people we knew were getting married were like, hey, use this cool new thing we developed. But honestly, like, it was all word of mouth and a little bit of organic social media. And again, it's nothing to write home about, 80 people, but for us working part-time, you know, on nights and weekends, we were like, this is awesome. This is great. People like it. And it's been interesting. So with that, we were able to go, like, listen, this is a really great idea to our friends and family. We've already proved we built the product already. So you want to de-risk as much for investors as possible. We built the product. Now we just need money to continue to build on the product and now to acquire more users.
So with 80 couples, though, because you have a high ticket sale, per couple transaction value is pretty high, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So we call it an event cart value. It's very high for us. You know, it's over $2,000.
So that means that with even with 80, 85 couples, you still had a substantial amount of revenue that you could show to that first friends and family round investors.
Correct. And it's
okay. So then you went from these like 80 couples to 2,000 couples in 2015, and you did over $4 million in sales. How did you acquire these customers? What was the key strategy that was converting for you?
Yeah, it was really, you know, if you think about 2014, 2015, it was really all Facebook. So we started doing Facebook targeted marketing, paid ads. And, you know, Lizzie and I had basically done everything since day one. So we were doing all the marketing, figuring out audience types, figuring out creative, figuring out copy. Yeah. It was really interesting for both of us to do that. And that worked really well for us early on because, you know, we had a really interesting concept. We had a great message. We had great branding. And so it was easy for people to kind of be like, oh, this is really cool, because you think about the industry we're in. It's very stagnant. The wedding registry change market hasn't changed a lot. Big box retailers haven't changed a lot. So it was kind of an easy concept to sell users, and Facebook was the way to go because it was such easy targeting for us.
And when did you start layering in Pinterest?
We started layering on Pinterest maybe towards the end of 2015. Mm-hmm. Pinterest didn't really have a really organized paid platform at that moment in time. We started doing pins, and they worked, but we didn't have anyone doing it, right? Lizzie and I were doing it full time. So Lizzie was doing all product and design. I'm doing all the accounting, business. And so, you know, how do you split your time to do it? So we did some, but not a lot. Now Pinterest has obviously become much bigger. It's part of our platform now. But, you know, our two big ones today are still Facebook and Pinterest.
Talk about your business model.
Yeah, so our business model is very straightforward. I mean, it's a B2C model, so we sell to consumers and we make a commission off everything we sell. That's pretty much it in a nutshell. The interesting thing about us is we have such incredible consumer intelligence on users in terms of where they're located, what product mix, what the retailer mix is, that retailers are actually asking us for that data and willing to pay for it. So now we're trying to figure out, right, how do we add that layer onto our revenue streams.
So you did something quite unorthodox at this point. In 2016, you applied for Techstars with substantial revenues and a fully validated business model at this point, and also you had validated your customer acquisition model. There are several questions on that decision. Why did you wait so long? And why did you apply to Techstars at all once you were already that far along?
Yeah, so, you know, Liz and I had been working on this for 2 years. We were incredibly tired. We'd been doing this nights and weekends for a long time. And, you know, quite frankly, we pride ourselves on continually learning. And, you know, there's a lot of things we don't know. And so, you know, we applied to Techstars because we had a connection there. And they tell us, listen, this is a great program. Like, you guys have revenue. Like, we're actually looking for that now. And so when we applied, there was a new specific accelerator for Techstars that was a retail-focused one. And that captivated us a lot because it was focused on retail companies, and we were in that space, and it was going to be much more focused in their resources. And I think, you know, as just a caveat for other entrepreneurs thinking about applying to Techstars, Techstars is very specific to each program. So certain Techstars programs skew towards very young, early-stage companies, and then the more corporate accelerators they're doing now usually skew, it sounds like, skews more towards later stage because everyone in our class had been in business for over a year, and we kind of had a more mature class, so to speak. And so I think it depends on which program an entrepreneur applies to.
So Techstars, of course, gives you $100,000 for about 7% of equity. How much did you raise coming out of Techstars?
Yeah, and so that was the big question going into Techstars, is it worth giving up the 7% equity to join? Ultimately, we said yes because that learning experience and the potential on the back end was worth it. So we ended up doing it. It was an unbelievable experience. I would highly recommend it to anyone in a similar situation to us. And on the back end of that, we ended up raising $1 million in seed funding, incredible list of investors, and it was reinvigorating for both Lizzie and I. So to understand and see development from other teams, to learn how Techstars runs their program, I mean, it's all stuff we've now brought back, and we're a better company for it, to be perfectly honest.
So let me ask you one question, though. Could you have raised that money without Techstars?
No, absolutely not. Techstars gives you the platform to raise. An analogy I like to use is, you know, if you go to an Ivy League school, you have a better chance of getting a good job, but it's no means guaranteed. You know, if you go to an accelerator program, you know, there's no means guaranteed success, but you'll have a better shot at being successful and raising capital because now you have a platform and a credential to go raise off of, essentially.
And you didn't have that network to do it yourself, is what you're saying.
Correct. So after, you know, we exhausted all friends and family around, we didn't have, it was hard to meet people, especially if you're in smaller markets. We're in the Seattle market, you know, it's a thriving tech scene, so to speak, but, you know, it's still very small for the angel community compared to New York or San Francisco.
All right. So one thing that, you know, I have been noticing, I've talked to other entrepreneurs who are doing that as well, is people are picking up on the fact that Techstars, Y Combinator, these are essentially operating like seed funds at this point. They started off in a different place. When they started almost, maybe almost a decade ago, they were operating in a slightly different stage of incubation, acceleration, whatever you call it. But today they are further along. So I've actually talked to many entrepreneurs who have, one, gotten into Y Combinator or Techstars, and two, had success in raising funding through Y Combinator or Techstars. As you said, you know, it's not a guarantee that you're going to be raising reasonable amounts of financing through Techstars or Y Combinator, but your chances are these people have good contacts and good networks, and if you don't have the network yourself, this is a reasonable place to go to get connected into networks. But the truth is, these accelerators make money off equity. So they are taking equity in your venture, so you kind of need to be worthy of them to take equity in your venture. So as a result, they are looking at taking more validated businesses. And your story, the reason I wanted to highlight the story is so it is a very pertinent story, and we have others we will show you in due course, of people who have validated their businesses outside for 2 years in your case before applying to Techstars. There's this preconception in the market that you kind of come up with an idea and you apply to Y Combinator, you apply to Techstars or whatever is your local accelerator. First and foremost, there are over 7,500 accelerators in the world, and most of them don't work. They don't really add a lot of value. Techstars and Y Combinator are two really high-quality accelerators. So it is worthwhile for you to understand how to get into these accelerators, one, and two, how to best leverage the time you spend in these accelerators, because you're going to be there for 3 months. And in 3 months, you can only do so much. So you almost need to be prepared to be able to do the funding round that you're going to do on demo day and following demo day at one of these accelerators going in. So this is why I love your story so much, Navin, is that you basically had all your ducks lined up and then you used their network. Yes, you learned a whole bunch of stuff within Techstars, but you also were kind of prepared to use their network and be successful in raising money. Do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, so a couple comments there. I think it's important for people looking to apply to accelerators such as a Y Combinator or a Techstars to make personal connections. So, like, do you know an entrepreneur who's gone through that program who can make an introduction to the program manager or can make an introduction into the program? So a lot of the companies that you talk about, either in our program or other programs, had some introduction other than just a blank application into the program. So it obviously helps your chances to have some knowledge or some interaction with them beforehand. So Techstars, they'll go around the world to meet with potential entrepreneurs. You need to go to those sessions, right, and meet those people so you can build a personal connection. So when they see your application come through, they're like, oh, yeah, I remember that entrepreneur. I talked to him. He was interesting. Let's review this a little bit more. So that's one thing. And two is I can't tell you how much I worked in the Techstars program. I think Lizzie and I both worked over 100 hours a week for 3 straight months. It was incredibly invigorating. We were surprised at how much we worked just because you spend so much time meeting people and doing meetings. I mean, we literally, there was one day we had meetings from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. and then at 7 we started working for our, you know, on Blueprint. And it's because of that we were able to raise, because you build that network, you start telling your story to more people, you refine your pitch, you understand how you're going to make it in the marketplace. And I think that's almost the most important thing. And I totally agree with you. We had the understanding, listen, we're coming in to learn and coming in to learn how we can fundraise, we can build this into a really big business and get to $1 million in net revenue within the next year.
Well, and as you are very viscerally pointing out, that time you spent was largely in networking. The hard work you had put in for 2 years to actually get your business validated, get you the revenues flowing, get the customers transacting on your website, get your product working and all of that, that was already done. And that takes time. So don't come in, yeah. Don't try to come into a Techstars or a Y Combinator thinking that in 3 months you're gonna build your MVP, you're gonna, you know, get customers transacting. That just doesn't work that way. And I think Y-Com in the tech side understands that. So no matter who is going to introduce into Y Combinator or Techstars, you're not going to be able to, get in or be able to leverage the time that you're in there unless you have the goods. And in your case, Navin, you have the goods because you bootstrapped with a paycheck for 2 years and with some friends and family financing to get all those goods lined up before you went in to Techstars.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's, you know, the reason I wanted to really highlight your story and get it out there is because people don't really understand how these programs work in a broad sense. So they're basically applying to Y Combinator and thinking that something will happen. It just doesn't work that way. So the perspective that you bring from the from the field and from the ground is very, very helpful. Thank you for sharing, Navin, and good luck. You have a long way to go, and I will be rooting for you. It's wonderful what you've done.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure, and I always love sharing the story because it takes a lot of work, a lot of perseverance, but, anyone can do it. It just takes time and energy.
And persistence, absolutely.
Yeah.